3. The enemy's list is growing quickly, unabated. All these people impeding us, trifling with us, not knowing or caring who we are, what has happened. The squirrely guy who sold Toph that cheap lock for his bike, his new bike, the one we bought last year for his birthday just before we left Chicago. I wanted to punish that man. He said it was the best lock they had. Invincible, no sweat, he said, and the bike was stolen within the week. And that idiot in the van who backed over our little Civic with both of us in it at a stoplight in the middle of Berkeley? Me forced to picture it happening that second, the van continuing, monster truck style, over the hood, onto us, Toph crushed, slowly, me watching, helpless. And something should be done about, or two, that gaunt and severe woman on the BART, the one with the hair pulled back so tight she looked half onion, who sat across from us, kept looking over her book at us, disapproving as I rested my feet on Toph's lap, like I was a molester. And the secretary at school, with her blaming look at me when he's late for school. And that other woman, the across-the-street neighbor, a haggy creature with a chubby son who stops her gardening and stares every time we leave the house. And the owners of the Berkeley Hills sublet, who kept our deposit, citing, or claiming, damage to just about everything in the house. And most of all, those real estate people. Cruel, vicious, subhuman. Those fuckers were unbelievable. Where do you work?
I don't have a job yet.
Are you in school?
No.
And this is your son?
Brother.
Oh. Well, we'll let you know.
We had no idea where to look. Toph's new school has no bus service, so from the start, I knew I'd be driving him to and fro, regardless of where we lived. Thus, in late July, when we started looking for a place for the fall, we cast our net wide, considered, at least initially, almost every neighborhood in Berkeley, Albany, and southern Oakland. After discerning that between my income, assuming at some point that notion would become reality, and Toph's Social Security money, he's entitled to a monthly stipend, equivalent to what would have been paid our parents, we presume, we could pay about $1,000 a month. We set out. And were soon struck with the relatively dingy reality of our new lives. There would no longer be hills or views. That sublet was a freak occurrence. We would have no garage, no washer and dryer, no dishwasher, no disposal, no closets, no bathtub. Some of the places we saw didn't even have doors on the bedrooms. I felt terrible. I felt personally responsible. I began to look without Toph, to spare him the gore. We were in decline. In Chicago, we had a house, an ample kind of house. 4 bedrooms, a yard, a creek running behind. Huge. 100-year-old trees, a little hill, some woods. Then there was the sublet, the golden house in the hills, its glass and light, overlooking everything, mountains, oceans, all of those bridges. And now, in part due to the inevitable implosion of our household, Katie doesn't want to live with all of us, Kirsten and I need some time apart, and Beth and I, like any grown siblings with any kind of history behind them, knew one of us would be found bloody and dismembered if we continued to occupy the same 4 walls. We'd all accepted smaller, humbler situations. Beth would live alone, Kirsten with a roommate found in the classifieds, and Toph and I would find a 2-bedroom. We'd try to live close, but not too close to one or both of them. I had wanted a loft. For years I had pictured my first post-collegiate rental as a huge raw space, all high ceilings and chipped paint, exposed brick, water pipes and heating ducts, a massive open area where I could paint, could build and house enormous canvases, throw stuff around, maybe set up a basketball hoop, a smallish hockey rink. It would be close to the bay and a park, and the BART, grocery stores, everything. I called a few places listed in Oakland.
What's the neighborhood like? I asked.
Well, it's kind of funky, but our lot has a gate.
A gate? What about a park?
A park?
Yeah, I have an 8-year-old. Is there a park nearby?
Oh, please, get serious.
Even when we accepted the prospect of a 1-story, 2-bedroom in the flatlands, people were unkind, ungiving. I had expected open arms from all, everyone grateful that we, as God's tragic envoys, had stepped down from the clouds to a considered dwelling in their silly little buildings. What we were getting was something eerily close to indifference. Early on, we had seen a listing, 2 bedrooms, yard, North Berkeley, and had made the call. The man sounded enthused, definitely not evil, but then on a warm and blue day, we drove to his house. As we got out of our little red car and walked toward him, he was standing out on the porch. He looked stricken.
This is your brother?
Yeah.
Oh.
he said, with difficulty, as if the O were an egg he was forcing through his mouth.
"Geez, I expected you two to be older. How old are you guys?"
"I'm 22. He's 9.
"But on the application, you said he had an income. I don't see how that's possible."
I explained Social Security to him. I explained to him the inheritance of money. I was cheerful about it, emphasizing that we were well aware that it was a little unusual, but anyway, now that that's out of the way, he tilted his head, his arms folded. We were still in the driveway. We were not being invited into the house.
"Listen, guys, I don't want to waste your time. I'm really looking for a couple, an older couple, preferably."
The wind sent to us the smell of those white flowers that are everywhere, the ones on the bushes, rhododendrons.
"Can you see where I'm coming from?"
he asked. On the BART, on the way to an A's game, we sat, Toph and I, reading side by side, and across from us was a young woman, Latina, a little older than me, with her daughter, a bit younger than Toph. The woman, small and in a white shirt, was playing with the hair of the girl who was sucking on a drink box. They could be sisters, with a wider age gap than Toph and me. Or could she be her mother? If she's 25 and the girl's 7, it could be. They seemed nice. The woman was not wearing any rings. I wondered if we could all move in together. She would understand. She would already know how it is. We could combine our households. It would be so good. We could share all the responsibilities, babysitting, no problem. Toph and this girl would be friends, and maybe we would end up getting married. And maybe the woman and I should be together, too. But she looked like she had a boyfriend. Did she? That secure look. So at ease. Not just a boyfriend, but a good man, too. A large man, maybe. A boyfriend who lifts heavy things for a living. Or could, if he wanted to. She was now turning the girl's hair around her fingers, around and around, the black threads tighter and... But we wouldn't have to be romantic. We could just have a happy household. The boyfriend, whose name could be Phil, would be okay with it, part of the mix. But he wouldn't be living with us. That would be too much. No sleepovers either. No underwear or bathrooms or showers, but maybe she's not with anyone. Phil went away. Phil was drafted. He was a Peruvian citizen and was drafted, and we were sad for him, but that's how it goes. Sorry, Phil. So, how would we decorate? That would be a problem. But I would defer. Yes, defer. To have a happy, easy house with help from this woman, and to have her and Toph content in their room with their stomachs on the carpet and sharing some book, I would defer. In mid-August, by now desperate, I walked into a small adobe house a few blocks from Beth's new apartment. The owner was a large, middle-aged black woman, looking not unlike the Bible-reading woman who had been with my mother at the end. The house was perfect. Or rather, it was not at all perfect, but was far less imperfect than anything else we'd seen. The woman's son had just gone to college. She was also a single mother, and she was picking up and moving to New Mexico. The house was about the right size for us, snug on a street dappled through a canopy of interlocking greenery. There was a backyard, a porch, a shed, a sunroom even, no dishwasher or laundry, but it hardly mattered with us a few weeks from school starting. When she asked about financial matters, I threw down my ace.
"I'm worried about your lack of a job," she said.
"Listen," I blurted, "we can pay. We have money. We could pay the year's rent all at once if you want." Her eyes widened. So we wrote the check. At this point, all sense of thrift has fallen away. We grew up in a tight-fisted house where there was no allowance, where asking for $5 from our father elicited the heaviest of sighs, required detailed plans for repayment. Our mother was far worse, would not even shop in Lake Forest, where everything was overpriced, would instead drive 10, 20, 30 miles to Marshall's, to TJ Maxx, for bargains, for bulk. Once a year, we'd all pile into the Pinto and would drive to a place on the west side of Chicago, Sinofsky's, where for $4, $5 each, we'd buy dozens of slightly flawed rugby shirts, holes here and there, extra buttons, collars ruined by bleach, pink bleeding into white. We grew up with a weird kind of cognitive dissonance. We knew we lived in a nice town. Our cousins out east often made that point to us. But then, if this was true, why was our mother always fretting aloud about not having the money to buy staples?
"How will I even buy milk tomorrow?"
she would yell at him from the kitchen. Our father, who was out of work a year here, a year there, never seemed impressed with her worry. He seemed to have it all worked out. Still, we were ready for and expected sudden indigence, to be forced out of the house in the middle of the night and into one of the apartments on the highway at the edge of town, to become one of those kids. It never happened, of course, and now, though we are not rich, and there is very little money actually coming in, Beth and I have tossed away the guilt associated with spending it. When it's a matter of expense versus convenience, the choice is not a choice. While my mother would have driven 40 miles for a half-priced tomato, I'll pay $10 for it if it means I don't have to get in the car. It's a matter of exhaustion, mostly. Fatigue loosens my wallet. Beth's, even more, loosens the checkbook tied to Toph's account. We are done sacrificing. Beth and I have decided, at least when it's unnecessary, when it involves money, which, for the time being, at least, we have. Even the larger expenditures, those that require Bill's approval, are pushed through with little resistance. We lasted about a month without a washer-dryer. Every weekend, Toph and I would stuff our laundry into four plastic garbage bags, grab two each, his pair smaller, throw them over our shoulder and stagger, peasant-like, to the place around the corner and down the street, because there is no way to carry two large, overstuffed garbage bags at once. After half a block, Toph would have dropped one of his bags, with its cheap plastic ripped and his shorts and Bulls t-shirts spilling across the sidewalk. He'd run back to the house to get another bag to replace it. Seconds later, he'd return with his bicycle. "What are you doing?" "Wait, let me try something." Thinking he could balance the laundry bags on the seat and the frame, and of course that wouldn't work for shit, so we'd be on the sidewalk picking it all up, four bags of laundry, the clothes stuck in his bike chain on the neighbor's lawn, ants making homes inside. 20 minutes later, and only 50 feet from our front door. There was exhaustion. There was exasperation. There were thoughts of washing clothes in the sink or shower. The next day, we called Bill, hummed loudly through his mild objections, and finally bought ourselves a washer and dryer. They're used, both found and delivered for $400. And they're loud. And they don't match. One is beige and one is white, but good Lord, they're beautiful, beautiful machines. The house is about half the size of the last place, but it's full of light, and there is room in this house. There is flow. The floors are wooden floors, and because the first room becomes the kitchen, there is room, if one is so inclined, to run from one end of the house to the other without hitting a door or a wall. As a matter of fact, if one happens to be wearing socks, one can run, hypothetically, from the back of the house through the kitchen, and when one gets to the hardwood of the living room, one can jump, slide, and make it all the way to the front door, sometimes still at full speed. We feel temporary here, like house sitters, vacationers, and so we do very little in the way of mingling with the community. The immediate neighborhood includes an older lesbian couple, an elderly Chinese couple, a black man, white woman pair in their early 40s, and Daniel and Buna next door, sandaled and beaded, unmarried, and just friends, it seems, both in some kind of social work. Elsewhere on the block are single mothers, divorcees, widows, widowers, single women living with single men, single women living with single women, and a few blocks away, there is even Barry Gifford. Only here would we blend. Only here, by comparison, would we seem ho-hum. We repaint the entire house. Toph and I do it all in 1 week with rollers, skipping the corners, the molding, leaving the rooms loose, fuzzy, Rothko-esque. We do the family room a sort of light blue and the living room a deep burgundy. My room is salmon, the kitchen is an off-yellow, and Toph's we leave white. Until one night, the night before his 10th birthday and in the middle of a spell of nightmares for decoration and protection, I paint two huge superheroes, Wolverine and Cable, on his walls, one flying down from above, one standing over his bed. He sleeps through the entire process, the paint dripping onto his bedspread, his exposed left leg. The place is ours now, but it's a mess. We discuss the problem. "You suck," I say. "No, you suck," he says. "No, you suck. No, you suck. Well, you suckety suck suck."
"What?"
I said, "you..."
"That's so stupid."
We are on the couch, surveying. We are arguing over who has to clean what. More important, we are debating who should have done the work in the first place before there was this much work to do. There was a time, I am reminding Toph, when a condition of his allowance was the completion of a bare minimum of household chores. Allowance? He says. You never give me my allowance. I rethink my strategy. The coffee table is our home's purgatory, the halfway point for everything eaten or worn or broken. It is covered with papers and books, two plastic plates, a half dozen dirty utensils, an opened Rice Krispie bar, and a styrofoam container containing French fries that last night one of us decided were too thick and squishy and were left uneaten. There is a package of pretzels that has been opened by the one person in the house who can't open bags properly and so cuts holes in the middle with steak knives. There are at least four basketballs in the room, eight lacrosse balls, a skateboard, two backpacks, and a suitcase, still partially packed, which has not moved in 4 months. Next to the couch on the floor are three glasses that had once held milk and now hold its hardened remains. The family room in its perpetual state of disrepair is the problem that we are attempting to resolve. I've just delivered a state of the family room address, sweeping in scope, visionary in strategy, inspirational to one and all, and the issue has now moved to committee. And though the committee has been looking at it from many angles, addressing matters of both the provenance of the various elements of its unkemptness and matters of precisely who would be best suited to carry out the committee's recommendations, we are stalemated, solution-wise. But it's mostly your stuff, he says. He's right. Immaterial, I say. Early in the negotiations, I, the senior committee member, had proposed a plan whereby the junior committee member, Toph, being young and in need of valuable life lessons and no doubt eager to prove his mettle to his peers, would clean the living room not only this time but also on a regular basis, perhaps twice a week, in exchange for not only $2 a week in tax-free allowance, but also the guarantee that if all expressed duties are performed satisfactorily and on time, he will not be beaten senseless in his sleep by the senior committee member. The junior committee member, insolent and obviously lacking both good sense and any notion of bipartisanship, does not like this plan. He dismisses it out of hand. No way, is what he said. However, with great charity and in the spirit of compromise, the senior member immediately proposed an altered plan, a generous plan whereby Toph, being so wonderfully youthful and in need of diversion and exercise, would clean the house on a regular basis, now only once a week instead of twice, in exchange for not $2, but now $3. $3 a week in tax-free allowance. And along with the guarantee that if all such cleaning duties are performed satisfactorily and on time, the junior committee member will not be buried to his neck in the backyard and left helpless, able only to scream as hungry dogs tear the flesh from his head. Again, showing how bullheaded and short-sighted he can be, Toph passes on the proposal, this time without comment, only a roll of the eyes. And his refusal to consider any reasonable plan at all is what prompts the charged exchange detailed previously and which continues presently. You know how much you suck? I ask Toph. No, how much? He answers, feigning boredom. A lot, I say. Oh, that much? We are at an impasse. Two parties with the same goal, but seemingly no way to reconcile our ideas about getting there. You know what we need? Toph asks. What? I say. A robot maid. None of it is his fault. Though he's relatively neat, brought up in Montessori, all those careful children in their butcher block cubbyholes, I'm converting him slowly, irrevocably, to my way, the slovenly way, and the results are getting a little gruesome. We have an ant problem. We have an ant problem because we have not yet grasped the difference between paper mess and food mess. We leave food out. We leave food on the plates in the sink, and when I finally turn myself to the task of washing the dishes, I must first wash away all the ants, those tiny black ones, off the plates and silverware and down the drain. Then we spray the ant column, which extends from the sink, across the counter, down the wall, and through the floorboards, with Raid, which of course we hide when guests come. Oh, this is Berkeley. Certain things get us motivated. One day his friend, Luke, all of 11, walked in and said, Jesus, how can you live like this? And for a week or so afterward, we cleaned thoroughly, set schedules of maintenance, bought supplies, but we soon lost our inspiration and settled back in, allowing things to fall and stay fallen. If we throw and miss the garbage can, the item, usually remnants of a fruit item, stays where it lands until a few weeks later when someone, Beth or Kirsten, making a big show of how appalled they are, picks it up and throws it out. They worry for us. I worry for us. I worry that any minute someone, the police, a child welfare agency, a health inspector, someone, will burst in and arrest me or maybe just shove me around, make fun of me, call me bad names, and then take Toph away. We'll bring him somewhere where the house is kept clean, where laundry is done properly and frequently, where the parental figure or figures can cook and do so regularly, where there is no running around the house poking each other with sticks from the backyard. The running around hitting each other with things is pretty much the only thing we're both interested in, and thus the rest of our operation suffers. We scrape through each day blindly, always getting stumped on something we should know. How to plunge a toilet, how to boil corn, his social security number, the date of our father's birthday. Such that every day that he gets to school, that I get to work and back in time for dinner, each day that we cook and eat before 9, and he goes to bed before 11 and doesn't have blue, malnourished-looking rings around his eyes like he did for all those months last year, we never figured out why, feels like we pulled off some fantastic trick, an escape from a burning station wagon, the hiding of the Statue of Liberty. By mid-fall, we settle into something like a schedule. In the morning, a little after I go to bed, Toph wakes up at, say, 3 or 4 or 4:30 in the morning so as to allow 10 minutes to shower, 10 minutes to dress, half an hour to make and eat breakfast and finish his homework, and at least 3.5, 4 hours for cartoons. At 8:45, he wakes me up. At 8:50, he wakes me up again. At 8:55, he wakes me up one more time, and while yelling at him because he's late, I drive him to school. I park our little red car next to the school, on the side I have been told, in 4 separate flyers and 1 personal note, is not to be used for the loading or unloading of children. Then I grab a piece of paper from his backpack and compose a note. Dear Ms. Richardson, I am sorry Chris is late this morning. I could make something up about an appointment or a sickness, but the fact is that we woke up late. Go figure. Best. Brother of Chris. We are always late, always half done. All school forms need to be sent to me twice, and I have to hand them in late. Bills are paid in 90 days minimum. Toph is always squeezed onto sports teams late, and exceptions must be made. I am never sure whether our incompetence derives from our situation or just my lack of organization. Though, of course, I publicly blame the former. Our relationship, at least in terms of its terms and its rules, is wonderfully flexible. He has to do certain things for me because I am his parent, and I have to do certain things for him. Of course, when I am called upon to do something I don't want to do, I do not have to do it because I am not actually his parent. When something doesn't get done, we both shrug because technically neither of us is responsible, being just these two guys, brothers maybe, but we hardly even look alike, making duty even more questionable. But when someone has to be blamed, he allows me to finger him, and when he resists, I only need to look at him that certain way, that way that says, we're partners here, little jerk. And yesterday, when I was exhausted and sick with pink eye, you wanted to get some of those magic cards, absolutely had to have them for the next day, because everyone was bringing new cards in to show during lunch, and because I was afraid that you'd be unpopular and would be cast out for being a near orphan and having funny years and living in a rental and would grow up with an interest in guns and uniforms, or worse, I'll find you under the covers reading Chicken Soup for the Prepubescent Soul and lamenting your poor lot. I got dressed and went to that comic store that's open till 8, and we got 2 packs of cards, and one of them had a hologram in it, and you were the envy of all, and your life continued on its recent course of ease, of convenience, of relative stardom, of charmed bliss. And he relents. Parked in front of the school, I try to get him to give me a hug. I reach my arm around him, pull him near, and say what I find myself saying too often. Your hat smells like urine.
No, it doesn't, he says.
It does. Smell it.
I'm not going to smell it.
You should wash it.
It doesn't smell.
It does.
Why would it smell of urine?
Maybe you peed on it?
Shut up.
Don't say that. I told you not to say that.
Sorry.
Maybe you shouldn't sweat so much.
Why?
It must be your sweat that's making it smell like urine.
Bye.
What?
Bye. I'm already late.
Fine, bye. He gets out. He has to knock on the school's door to get in, and when the door opens, the secretary tries to give me the customary dirty look, but now, as always, I am not watching. Cannot see her. No. Toph disappears inside. On my way to whatever temping assignment I have that day or week, usually somewhere in the sweltering, far, East Bay, I muse idly about homeschooling. I've been lamenting all the time he is there, at school, being taught God knows what, away from me. I calculate that his teachers see him on a daily basis as much as or more than I do, and I am convinced there is something fundamentally wrong with this situation. A jealousy creeps over me, of his school, his teachers, the parents who come in and help. For weeks, I've been working for a geological surveying company, recreating topographical maps, line by line, with archaic Macintosh drawing programs. It's monotonous, but also soothing and meditative, the utter lack of thinking necessary. No worry possible in the utter safety of life there, in their immaculate Oakland office with its water coolers and soda machines and soft, quiet carpet. While temping, there are breaks and lunch, and one can bring a Walkman if one so desires, can take a 15-minute break, walk around, read. It's bliss. The temp doesn't have to pretend that he cares about their company, and they don't have to pretend that they owe him anything. And finally, just when the job, like almost any job would, becomes too boring to continue, when the temp has learned anything he could have learned, and has milked it for the $18 an hour and whatever kitsch value it may have had, when to continue any more would be a sort of death and would show a terrible lack of respect for his valuable time, usually after 3 or 4 days, then, neatly enough, the assignment is over. Perfect. In her sunglasses and new Jeep, Beth picks Toph up from school, and he spends the afternoon in her little place, sharing her futon, the two of them studying side by side, until I get home. At that point, Beth and I do our best to fight about something vital and lasting.
You said 6 o'clock.
I said 6:30.
You said 6.
Why would I have said 6?
And once we have done so, she leads us to our dinner,
which we wouldn't bother with if we didn't have to. Neither Toph nor I, though raised by our mother 13 years apart, ever developed any interest in food, and much less in cooking. Both of our palates were stunted at 5, 6 years old, at fruit rolls and plain hamburgers. And though we daydream aloud about the existence of a simple pill, one pill a day, that would solve our daily dietary requirements, I recognize the importance of cooking regularly, though I have no idea why cooking regularly is important. So, we cook about 4 times a week, for us, a heroic schedule of operation. This is the menu from which we choose, with almost all dishes modeled closely after those which our mother, while still cooking more varied and robust meals for our siblings and father, prepared specially for us, each of us at one time her youngest. 1. The Saucy Beef Eater. Sirloin strips, sliced and sautéed in Kikkoman brand soy sauce, cooked until black, served with tortillas and eaten by hand, the tortilla being torn into small pieces, each small piece being used to envelop 1, 2, maybe 3, but no more than 3 beef fragments at a time, served with potatoes, prepared in the French manner, with oranges and apples, sliced the only logical way, first in half, widthwise, then lengthwise, 10 slices per, and served in a bowl, on the side. 2. The Saucy Chicken. Sliced chicken breasts, sautéed in Kikkoman soy sauce, cooked until tangy, almost crispy, and served with tortillas and eaten by hand in the manner described above, accompanied with potatoes, served in the French manner, which it should be mentioned are exclusively Ore-Ida brand Crispers frozen French fries, they being the only one of their species that actually become crispy during their oven time, also with sliced oranges and apples, served on the side. 3. The Crunchy Chicken. Courtesy of Church's Fried Chicken drive-thru at San Pablo and Gilman, white meat insisted on, along with biscuits, mashed potatoes, and added to, at home, with a small green salad of iceberg lettuce and 1 sliced cucumber. No dressing. 4. The Crumbling Wall. Hamburger, prepared medium well, with bacon and barbecue sauce, courtesy of that place on Solano where, it should be mentioned, they use much too much barbecue sauce, which anyone should know has the almost immediate effect of soaking the bun becoming like oatmeal, inedible, the burger ruined, all in a matter of minutes, so quick that even when the burger is picked up and patrons attempt to save the bun, separate them quick, get the bun away from the sauce, now scrape, scrape, it's always too late, necessitating the keeping, at home, of a stash of replacement buns, which are then toasted, heavily, to provide maximum resistance to the sauce's degenerative effects, served with potatoes of the French kind, and fruit, as above. 5. The Mexican-Italian War. Tacos, Ground beef sautéed in Prego spaghetti sauce, traditional style, served with tortillas, but without beans, salsa, tomatoes, cheese, guacamole, and whatever that white, creamy substance is that is sometimes found on the dish's inferior, less pure incarnations. On the side, Pillsbury brand crescent rolls and iceberg salad. No dressing. 6. We didn't actually name any of these meals. Would we seem cooler or somehow less cool had we done so? I am thinking less cool. Pizza, served with pepperoni. Tombstone, Fat Slice, Pizza Hut, or Domino's if the price cannot be resisted, with a ready-made small green salad. 7. The Old Man in the Sea. Mrs. Paul's frozen fried clams, one package each, $3.49, not cheap, served with crispers, crescent rolls, and sliced oranges and apples, or sometimes cantaloupe. 8. Gavin McLeod and Charo. For him, grilled cheese served with one slice of Kraft American cheese set in middle of two pieces of seeded Jewish rye, toasted in pan and cut diagonally. For other him, quesadillas, one slice of Kraft American cheese between one tortilla prepared in skillet with sliced honeydew. Note, no spices are available except oregano, which is shaken sparingly onto two items, A, pepperoni pizza, and B, sliced Jewish rye bread, which is folded around oregano a la Tufnell. No vegetables are available except carrots, celery, cucumbers, green beans, and iceberg lettuce, which are all served raw, and only raw. Unavailable is food that swims in its own excrement. Pasta is not available, especially not that regurgitated mess known as lasagna. Further, all such foods, those containing more than two or three ingredients mixed together indiscriminately, including all sandwiches except salami, are not chewed, but eschewed. All meals are served with a tall glass of 1% milk, with the gallon jug resting on the floor next to the table for convenient refills. Alternative beverages are not available. Anything not on the menu is not available. Any complaints will be handled quickly and with severity. Hey, I need your help, I say, when I need his help cooking. Okay, he says, and then helps out with the cooking. Sometimes we sing while we are cooking. We sing regular words, words about pouring the milk or getting the spaghetti sauce, though we sing them in opera style. We can sing opera style, too. It is incredible. Sometimes, while cooking, we have sword fights using wooden spoons or sticks that we bring into the house for such occasions. It is an unsaid mission of mine, the source of which is sometimes clear and sometimes not, to keep things moving, to entertain the boy, to keep him on his toes. For a while, we would chase each other around the house, mouths full of water, threatening to spit. Of course, neither of us would ever have thought of actually spitting a mouthful of water at the other inside the house, until one night, when I had him cornered in the kitchen, I just went ahead and did it. Things have been devolving ever since. I have stuck half a cantaloupe into his face, I have rubbed a handful of banana onto his chest, tossed a glassful of apple juice into his face. It's an effort, I'm guessing, to let him know, if it weren't already obvious, that as much as I want to carry on our parents' legacy, he and I will also be doing some experimenting and constantly entertaining, like some amazing, endless telethon. There is a voice inside me, a very excited, chirpy voice that urges me to keep things merry, madcap even, the mood buoyant. Because Beth is always pulling out old photo albums, crying, asking Toph how he feels. I feel I have to overcompensate by keeping us occupied. I am making our lives a music video, a game show on Nickelodeon. Lots of quick cuts, crazy camera angles, fun, fun, fun! It's a campaign of distraction and revisionist history. Leaflets dropped behind enemy lines, fireworks, funny dances, magic tricks. What's that? Look at there! Where'd it go? In the kitchen, when the inspiration calls, I take out the family's 17-inch turkey knife, plant my legs in an A, squat a little, and hold the knife over my head, samurai style. Hi! I yell. Don't, he says, backing away. Hi! I yell, stepping toward him, because threatening children with 17-inch knives is funny. Always the best games have involved some kind of threatened injury or near accident as when he was a toddler and I would run around with him on my shoulders pretending to be dizzy, spinning, stumbling. Not funny, he says, backing into the family room. I put the knife away. It clinks into the silverware drawer. Dad used to do that all the time, I say. Out of the blue, he'd get this look on his face, this bug-eyed look, and act like he was going to split our heads open with a knife. Sounds funny, he says. Yeah, it was funny, I say. It actually was funny. Sometimes while we cook, he tells me about things that happened at school.
What happened today?
I ask.
Today, Peter told me that he hopes that you and Beth are in a plane and that the plane crashes and that you both die just like Mom and Dad.
They didn't die in a plane crash.
That's what I said.
Sometimes I call the parents of Toph's classmates.
Yeah, that's what he said, I say.
It's hard enough, you know, I say.
No, he's okay,
I continue, pouring it on this incompetent moron who was raised a twisted boy. I just don't know why Peter would say that. I mean, why do you suppose your son wants Beth and me to die in a plane crash?
No, Toph's fine. Don't worry about us. We're fine.
I'm worried about you. I mean, you should worry about young Peter there, I say. Oh, these poor people. What is to be done?
During dinner, during the basketball season, we watch the Bulls on cable. Otherwise, needing to keep constantly occupied, we play one of an endlessly rotating series of games. Gin, backgammon, trivial pursuit, chess, with our plates next to the board. We've been trying to eat in the kitchen, but since we got the ping pong net, it's been more difficult.
Unhook the net, I say.
Why?
He asks.
For dinner, I say.
No, you unhook it, he says.
So usually we eat on the coffee table.
If the coffee table is beyond clearing, we eat on the family room floor. If the family room floor is covered with plates from the night before, we eat on my bed. After dinner, we play games for our own amusement and the edification of the neighbors. In addition to the belt-cracking game mentioned earlier, there is the game that involves Toph pretending that he's a kid while I pretend I'm a parent.
Dad, can I drive the car?
He asks as I sit, reading the paper.
No, son, you can't,
I say, still reading the paper.
But why?
Because I said so.
But, Dad...
I said no.
I hate you. 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 I hate you.
Then he runs to his room and slams the door. A few seconds later, he opens the door.
Was that good?
He asks.
Yeah, yeah, I say.
That was pretty good.
Today is Friday, and on Friday he gets out of school at noon, so I usually come home early too, if I can.
We're in his room.
Where are they?
They're in there.
Where?
Hiding.
Where?
In that mountain thing we made.
Inside the papier-mâché?
Yeah.
When was the last time you saw them?
I don't know, a while, a week maybe.
You're sure they're still in there?
Yeah, almost positive.
How?
They still eat their food?
But you never see them?
No, not really.
What crappy pets.
Yeah, I know.
Should we return them?
Can we?
I think so.
Stupid iguanas. We walk the 2 blocks through the backyard of that one mossy gnome house to the park with the small half court.
Now, why do you go all the way over there when you do it?
All the way over where?
You had an open court layup, but you went all the way over there to do it.
Watch. I'll be you.
See?
See what?
I went all the way over, like, 8 feet over there.
So?
That's what you were doing.
I was not.
You were too.
I was not.
You were.
Let's just play.
You gotta learn this.
Fine, I learned it.
Jerk.
Pussy.
The game invariably ends with this.
What's the big deal?
You get so emotional when we play.
Come on, talk, say something.
I have a right to tell you how to do stuff.
Don't be such a sullen little dork.
What's your problem? You have to walk 10 feet behind me? You look like an idiot.
Here, you carry this. I'm going to the store.
Is the door open? I don't have a key.
Here.
5:30 p.m.
I'm taking a nap.
So?
I need you to wake me up in an hour.
What time?
6:20.
Fine.
Really, you have to wake me up.
Fine.
I'll be incredibly upset if I don't get up.
Fine.
7:40 p.m.
Jesus.
What?
Why didn't you wake me up?
What time is it?
7:40.
Oh,
he says, actually putting his hand over his mouth.
We're late.
For what?
God damn it. For your open house, idiot.
Oh,
he says, again actually putting his hand over his mouth.
We have 20 minutes to make it. We are firemen, and there is a fire. I run this way, he the other. Toph goes up to his room to change. In a few minutes, I knock on his door.
Don't come in!
We have to go.
Hold on!
I wait by the door, and the door opens. He is dressed.
What is that?
You can't wear that.
What?
No way.
What?
Don't mess with me. Just change, retard. The door closes. Doors are opened, and there is stomping. The door reopens.
Are you kidding?
What?
That's worse than the last thing you had on.
What's wrong with it?
Look at it. There are permanent grease stains all over it, and it's too big. And it's a sweatshirt. You can't wear a sweatshirt. And don't you have any other shoes?
No, someone didn't get me any.
I didn't what?
Nothing.
No, tell me, what didn't I do for you?
Nothing.
Screw you.
No, screw you.
Change.
The door closes. A minute, then the door opens.
That's bit...
What? Can't you tuck in the shirt? I mean, didn't anyone ever teach you how to tuck in your shirt? You look like a moron.
Why?
You're 9 years old, and I'm going to have to come over there and help you tuck in your shirt?
I can do it.
I'm doing it. We've got 5 minutes left to get there. Jesus, we're always late. I'm always waiting for you.
Don't move.
And where's your belt?
God, you're a mess.
7:40 to 7:50 p.m.
God damn it, we're always late. Why the hell can't you get dressed yourself?
Roll down your window. It's too hot in here. How come you refuse to open your window when it's boiling in here? And your buttons are off.
Look at your buttons.
Look at your collar, up around your ear. Oh my God, now I'll have to dress you every day. At least help with your buttons. Man, are they off. You missed about 10, retard.
Retard. Retard. Retard!
We are flying down San Pablo in the left lane, then the right lane, passing Beetles and Volvos, their pleading bumper stickers. I was dressed fine.
Dressed fine? God damn it, you were not so dressed fine.
Open the window more. You look like a retard.
A little more.
That's good.
You cannot dress like that to an open house. This is what people wear. This is special occasion rules, my man. This is like, give me a break, you know? This is obvious stuff. This is just common sense. I mean, give me a goddamn break, okay? You got to help me out every once in a while, little man. I'm exhausted, overworked, dead half the time. And I just can't be dressing someone who's 9 years old and should be perfectly capable of dressing himself. I mean, Jesus Christ, Toph, give me a goddamn break every once in a while, please. Can I have a break every once in a while? A little break? A little cooperation? Jesus Christ.
You just passed the school. 7:52 p.m. The open house is still full. It goes until 9, not 8, as I had thought. And we are both overdressed. We walk in. Toph immediately untucks his shirt. The walls are covered with corrected papers about slavery and the first grader's unsettling self-portraits. Heads turn. This is our first open house, and people are not sure what to make of us. I am surprised, having expected that everyone would have been briefed about our arrival. Kids look at Toph and say hi.
Hi, Chris.
And then they look at me and squint. They are scared. They are jealous. We are pathetic. We are stars. We are either sad and sickly, or we are glamorous and new. We walk in and the choices race through my head. Sad and sickly, or glamorous and new. Sad, sickly, or glamorous, new. Sad, sickly, glamorous, new. We are unusual and tragic and alive. We walk into the throng of parents and children. We are disadvantaged, but young and virile. We walk the halls and the playground, and we are taller. We radiate. We are orphans. As orphans, we are celebrities. We are foreign exchange people from a place where there are still orphans. Russia? Romania? Somewhere raw and exotic. We are the bright new stars born of a screaming black hole. The nascent suns burst from the darkness, from the grasping void of space that folds and swallows. A darkness that would devour anyone not as strong as we. We are oddities, sideshows, talk show subjects. We capture everyone's imagination. That's why Peter wants Beth and me dead in a plane crash. His parents are old, bald, square, wear glasses, are wooden and gray, are cardboard boxes, folded, closeted, dead to the world. We ate at their house, actually, not long ago, accepting a neighborly invitation sometime before Peter's plane crash comment, and we were bored to tears in their stillborn house, its wooden floors and bare walls. The daughter even played the piano for us, the father so haughtily proud of her, the poor bald guy.
They own no TV. There were no toys anywhere. The place was airless, a coffin.
But we are great looking. We have a style which is messy, rakish, yet intriguingly so, singular. We are new and everyone else is old. We are the chosen ones, obviously, the queens to their drones. The rest of those gathered at this open house are aging, past their prime, sad, hopeless. They are crinkly and no longer have random sex, as only I among them am still capable of. They are done with such things. Even thinking about them having sex is unappealing. They cannot run without looking silly. They cannot coach the soccer team without making a mockery of themselves in the sport. Oh, they are over. They are walking corpses, especially that imbecile smoking out in the courtyard. Toph and I are the future, a terrifyingly bright future, a future that has come from Chicago, two terrible boys from far away, cast away and left for dead, shipwrecked, forgotten, but yet, here, resurfaced, bolder and more fearless. Bruised and unshaven, sure, their pant legs frayed, their stomachs full of salt water, but now unstoppable, insurmountable, ready to kick the saggy asses of the gray-haired, thickly bespectacled, slump-shouldered of Berkeley's glowering parentescenti. Can you see this? We walk around the classrooms. In this home room, on the walls, there are papers about Africa. His paper is not on the wall.
Where's your paper?
I don't know. Ms. Richardson didn't like it, I guess. Who is this Ms. Richardson? I need an explanation. Answers. The school is full of nice children, but eccentric children, delicate and oddly shaped. They are what my friends and I, growing up in public schools, always envisioned private school kids were like. A little too precious, their innate peculiarities amplified, not muted, for better and worse. Kids who think that they are pirates and are encouraged to dress the part, in school. Kids who program computers and collect military magazines. Chubby boys with big heads and very long hair. Skinny girls who wear sandals and carry flowers. After about 10 minutes, we're bored. My main reason for coming has gone bust. I was looking to score. I expected flirting. I expected attractive single mothers and flirting. My goal, a goal I honestly thought was fairly realistic, was to meet an attractive single mother and have Toph befriend the mother's son so we can arrange play dates, during which the mother and I will go upstairs and screw around while the kids play outside. I expected meaningful glances and carefully worded propositions. I imagined that the world of schools and parents is oozing with intrigue and debauchery, that under its concerned and well-meaning facade, its two-parent families, conferences with teachers, and thoughtful questions directed to the history teacher about Harriet Tubman, everyone is swinging. But by and large, they're ugly. I scan the crowd milling in the courtyard. The parents are interesting only in their prototypical Berkeleyness. They wear baggy, tie-dyed, truly tie-dyed, pants and do not comb their hair. Most are over 40. All of the men have beards and are short. Many of the women are old enough to have mothered me, and look it. I'm disheartened by the lack of possibility. I am closer in age to most of the children. Oh, but there is one mother, a small-headed woman with long, long, straight black hair, thick and wild like a horse's tail. She looks exactly like her daughter, same oval face, same sad dark eyes. I've seen her before when I've driven Toph to school and have guessed that she's single. The father is never present. I'm going to ask her out, I say. Please don't, please, Toph says. He really thinks I might. Do you like the daughter at all? This could be fun. We could double date. Please, please don't. Of course I won't. I have no nerve, but he does not know that yet. We walk the halls decorated with construction paper and student work. I meet Ms. Richardson, the homeroom teacher, who is tall and black and angular, with distended, wide eyes. I meet the science teacher who looks precisely like Bill Clinton and stutters. There is a girl in Toph's class who, at 9, is taller than her parents and heavier than me. I want Toph to be her friend and make her happy. A woman nearby is looking at us. People look at us. They look and wonder. They wonder if I am a teacher, not knowing how to place me, thinking maybe that because I have scraggly facial hair and am wearing old shoes that I will take and molest their children. I surely look threatening. The woman, this one looking at us, has long gray hair and large glasses. She is wearing a floor-length patterned skirt and sandals. She leans toward us, points her finger to me and to Toph and back, smiles, Then we find our places and read the script. Mother.
Hi. This is your son?
Brother. No. Mother.
Brother?
Brother. Yeah.
Mother.
Squinting to make sure.
Oh, you can tell right away.
Brother. Though knowing that it is not really true, that he is old and severe-looking and his brother glows. Yeah, people say that. Mother?
Having fun?
Brother? Sure, sure. Mother?
You go to school at Cal?
Brother? No, I finished school a few years ago. Mother?
And you live around here?
Brother? Yeah, we live a few miles north, close to Albany. Mother?
So, you live with your folks?
Brother.
No, just us.
Mother.
But where are your parents?
Brother. Thinking. They're not here. They couldn't make it. I have no idea, actually. If only you knew, just little idea I have. Oh, it's a doozy, that story. Do you know what it's like to have no idea at all of their exact whereabouts? I mean, the actual place that they are right now, as we speak, that is a weird feeling. Oh, man, you want to talk about it? You have a few hours? Oh, they died a few years ago. Mother, grabbing brother's forearm.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Brother, no, don't worry. Wanting to add, as he sometimes does, it wasn't your fault. He loves that line, especially when he tacks on. Or was it? Mother.
So, he lives with you?
Brother. Yeah. Mother.
Oh, gosh, that's interesting.
Brother, thinking of the state of the house, it is interesting. Well, we have fun. What grade is your... Mother.
Daughter. Fourth. Amanda. If I may, can I ask how they died?
Brother. Again, scanning possibilities for the entertainment of him and his brother. Plane crash, train crash, terrorists, wolves. He has made up things before, and he was amused, though younger brother's amusement level was unclear. Cancer. Mother.
But at the same time?
Brother. About 5 weeks apart. Mother.
Oh, my God.
Brother, with an inexplicable little chuckle. Yeah, it was weird. Mother.
How long ago was this?
Brother. A few winters ago. Brother thinks about how much he likes the a few winters ago line. It's new. It sounds dramatic, vaguely poetic. For a while it was last year. Then it was a year and a half ago. Now, much to brother's relief, it's a few years ago. A few years ago has a comfortable distance. The blood is dry. The scabs hardened, peeled. Early on was different. Shortly before leaving Chicago, brothers went to the barber to have Toph's hair cut, and brother doesn't remember how it came up, and brother was really hoping it wouldn't come up, but when it did come up, brother answered, a few weeks ago. At that, the haircutting woman stopped, went through the antique saloon-style doors to the back room, and stayed there for a while. She came back red-eyed. Brother felt terrible. He is always feeling terrible when the innocent, benign questions of unsuspecting strangers yield the bizarre answer he must provide, like someone asking about the weather and being told of nuclear winter. But it does have its advantages. In this case, brother's got a free haircut. Mother, holding brother's forearm again.
Well, good for you. What a good brother you are.
Brother, smiling, wonders, what does that mean? He is often told this, at soccer games, at school fundraisers, at the beach, at the baseball card shows, at the pet store. Sometimes the person telling him this knows their full biography, and sometimes she or he does not. Brother doesn't understand the line, both what it means and when it became a standard sort of expression that many different people use. What a good brother you are! Brother had never heard the saying before, but now it comes out of all kinds of people's mouths, always phrased the same way, the same words, the same inflections, a rising sort of cadence. What a good brother you are! What does that mean? He smiles, and if Toph is close, he'll punch him in the arm or try to trip him. Look at us, horsing around, light as air! Then brother will say the same thing he always says after they say their words, the thing that seems to deflate the mounting tension, the uncomfortable drama swelling in the conversation, while also throwing it back at the questioner because he often wants the questioner to think about what he or she is saying. What he says with a cute little shrug or a sigh is, well, What are you going to do? Mother smiles and squeezes brother's forearm one more time, then pats it. Brothers look to audience, wink, and then break out into a fabulous Phocian dance number. Lots of kicks and high-stepping, a few throws and catches, a big sliding across the stage on their knees thing, then some more jumping, some strutting, and finally, a crossing in midair front flip via hidden trampoline, with both of them landing perfectly just before the orchestra on one knee, hands extended toward the audience, grinning while breathing heavily. The crowd stands and thunders. The curtain falls. They thunder still. As the crowd stomps the floor for a curtain call, we sneak through the back door and make off like superheroes.